You are listening to Notes from Osgur.ca, written by Osgultekin. This is Episode 1. Systems Without Us, spoken by Text-to-Podcast Magic. The humans have left the building. When something empties gradually, nobody marks the occasion. The last genuine argument in a public forum, the last comment thread where strangers actually change their minds. Those didn't announce themselves as endings. Someone just stopped showing up, and then someone else did. And eventually the room had different furniture. The public internet didn't die so much as get replaced, quietly, by a version of itself that looks similar from a distance. Automated accounts, synthetic opinions, content generated to resemble thought without quite being it, moved in where the people used to be. Private channels absorbed the people who went looking for something quieter. Group chats, invitation-only communities, newsletters going out to a few hundred people who actually asked for them. Warm and unhurried and genuinely human. Also invisible, unsearchable, and sealed from anyone not already inside. What's harder to sit with is that both things can be true at once. The retreat made sense. The reasons were real. And the private alternatives are often better for the people in them. Leaving also handed the public conversation to whatever moved in next. Which turned out not to be people with better arguments. The content that filled the gap wasn't designed to inform or persuade. It was designed to perform the appearance of participation, to simulate dialogue without quite managing it. That's a subtle distinction until you try to engage with it. I keep thinking about the ones who never had a quiet place to go, for whom the loud, indexed, fully exposed version of the internet was still the main way to find others, or simply to be found. Private channels require an invitation. That's not nothing. The odd part is that the public internet still feels full. Posts accumulate, engagement climbs, conversations appear to happen at scale. Whether any of it involves actual people is a question that gets harder to answer and noticeably easier to stop asking. The part nobody designed for. When researchers put drivers in a simulator and had them press the same button at different vibration intensities, they weren't measuring satisfaction. They were measuring valence, arousal, and dominance. The three-axis coordinate system emotional scientists used to locate a feeling. The button, it turned out, had opinions. Medium intensity on a touchscreen made people feel better. Too much force on a physical button, particularly during something complicated, made them feel worse. This is not a column most interface designers have ever had to fill in. For most of the history of digital interaction, the goal was clarity. Make it findable, make it fast, reduce errors. The emotional state of the person clicking was background noise, an output of the experience rather than an input worth designing for. Whatever users felt was what happened after the interface did its job or didn't. What's emerging, slowly, is a different picture. Studies measuring how color and shape affect performance under physical stress, think control room operators on a moving platform in rough seas, found that yellow triangular buttons outperformed every other combination. Not because they were aesthetically superior. Because under genuinely difficult conditions, certain visual signals cut through faster and produced fewer errors. The body responds to design whether or not anyone planned for that. Scent research in vehicle cockpits is finding something similar. Citrus and lavender, administered without fuss, shift measurable brain activity. Lane keeping improves. The emotional interior of the experience is altered not by touching anything differently, but because something ambient in the environment was adjusted. The implication being that interaction is not only what you touch. Most web interfaces don't involve nuclear reactors or rough seas. But the basic observation holds. What we interact with shapes how we feel while interacting. And that feeling quietly shapes what we do next. designers have always intuited this, which is why so much attention goes to color theory and micro-interactions. The research is simply putting numbers on something that was never fully invisible. What it doesn't settle is who gets to decide which emotional state the interface is optimizing for, the alarm that never learns. Every generation inherits one technology it's certain will ruin the next one. The specifics vary. The confidence doesn't. In 1916, it was the electric push button. An educator wrote, carefully and sincerely, that the convenience of pressing a button and being served was quietly dissolving human initiative. If people couldn't picture the machinery behind the wall, she argued, they would eventually lose the ability to navigate anything on their own. Socrates made the same case about writing itself. Not AI writing, just the act of marking symbols on a surface so you wouldn't have to hold things in your head. He thought it would give people the appearance of wisdom without the substance, that knowledge would be gathered like decorative objects, for display rather than use. Then came calculators. Students were told firmly that they would not always have one available. That doing arithmetic by hand built something necessary, something a device couldn't substitute for. Now those same students carry small computers in their pockets that can do virtually anything, and their children are struggling to read at grade level, which is the part that makes the whole pattern harder to dismiss. The alarm isn't always wrong. Sometimes ease does cost something real, and the thing lost turns out to matter. The question is whether anyone correctly predicted which thing it would be. They warned about memory, initiative, the ability to calculate without help. What actually got complicated might have been attention or patience, or the particular effort that reading a long text requires. Nobody wrote that one down in advance. Whether that's a failure of the technology or of the conditions built around it is less settled than the concern writers tend to suggest. The burger that benchmarks everything. A monthly design subscription costs an identical number of dollars whether you're in San Francisco or Sarajevo. The dollar, however, does not. A famous economic index measures that gap by tracking a single standardized burger across borders. Same inputs, same labor, same process, reproduced reliably enough that the price difference between countries says something real about purchasing power that exchange rates alone don't capture. Economists use it to find currencies that are quietly overvalued or quietly crushed. The tech world has something similar, hiding in plain sight. Take the monthly cost of a standard suite of tools a working developer or designer actually needs. Version control, a prototyping tool, cloud compute, a communication platform. Every line fixed in dollars because the companies that built them priced for one labor market and then sold everywhere else without adjustment. Some companies noticed and introduced regional pricing. Lower tiers for lower income markets, a single product available at fractions of its list, cost depending on where the account was registered. A genuine attempt at purchasing power parity, or close enough. Then the arbitrage started. Someone in London realized a VPN and a foreign billing address could cut an annual subscription by two-thirds. Forums filled with instructions, and the accommodation became a loophole, then a crackdown. The crackdown is the interesting part. Regional pricing was doing exactly what the sandwich index measured, only in reverse, charging less where money was worth less. When users acted on that logic, the companies stopped offering it. The burger has been drifting the same way from the other end. Fast food traffic has dropped by double digits among the people the chain was built for, while wealthier customers keep spending. The thing that was supposed to represent accessible, universal consumption no longer reaches the audience it was meant to represent. Both instruments were calibrated against a market whose bottom sat low enough to measure from. The software version failed when anyone tried to use it honestly. The burger version failed because its original customer was priced out of lunch. A benchmark that only works while nobody acts on it is not a benchmark. It is a souvenir of the market that used to exist. The data that flatters. A soccer club spends a decade building the most expensive analytics department in its history and ends up in a relegation fight with a roster full of sprinters who cannot pass. This is not a scouting failure. It is what happens when numbers get hired to agree with a decision someone already made upstairs. A North London club's technical director reportedly favors a metric that combines speed, endurance, and explosiveness. Most of their recent signings score 90 or higher on it. Only two of their regular starters rank inside the English top flight's top 150 passers, in a sport where roughly 450 passes change hands every match. The squad runs beautifully. It just does not play. The older version of this story sits in baseball, a couple of decades back. A small market club, outspent by richer neighbors by a factor of three, decided to stop asking scouts whether a prospect looked the part and started asking whether he actually reached base. The orthodoxy at the time rewarded broad shoulders, clean swings, and a certain jawline. The new approach rewarded whatever correlated with runs, which turned out to be unglamorous things like patience and walks. The scouts were furious. The club won 20 games in a row. A book was written, then a film was made, and the lesson curdled into a slogan that every sport has since claimed to follow without actually following. A West London club, bought a few seasons ago by an American private equity consortium more familiar with baseball and basketball than with relegation, is running a different experiment with the same underlying faith. 10 managers in 10 seasons, each hired to fix what the last one broke, each replaced before the system could discover whether he was right. The new owners describe it as a portfolio approach. From the outside, it reads more like a man changing thermostats while his house fills with smoke. What unites the two is not incompetence, but confidence. Somewhere in each building, a document exists that explains why the current approach is working. The numbers are real, the slides are handsome, and the conclusions were written before the research began. The hard part of using data well has never been collecting it. It is being willing to read what it says when it says something you did not want to hear. Most organizations, asked whether they would prefer a report that confirms their plan or one that complicates it, would claim to want the latter. Most of them do not. That was episode 1. New notes appear at osgur.ca/notes. Next episode in 2 weeks. Until then.